S&P, the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is, despite expectation to the contrary, in correction territory. I'll rant about that in a minute, but in the meantime, I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, Dr. Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc. How are you?
G'day, Captain. I'm great. How are you?
Mate, I'm not really sure. So we're recording this on Friday morning. It's 20 to 10 as we literally say this. So for those who are wondering whether we're what time we're recording, what we're doing, it's 20 to 10. The market's going to open in less than 20 minutes. But the US markets overnight fell about 4.5%. So we might have a tough old day on the ASX. So how am I? I don't know. I'll probably tell you about 40 or 45 minutes, I reckon.
Fear not the market.
Fear not the market? Is that the new motto of
Motley
Fool Money?
Fear not the market.
There we go. I like it. We could go with that.
Yeah.
Other than that, mate, how are you?
I'm awesome.
Good to know.
Fear not the market is my
You're a happy man. All right. Mate, we've got a lot to cover, unsurprisingly, today, and it's going to be broken into about three sections. We'll start off with, yes, we're going to have to talk about it again, coronavirus. I might possibly rant about the term correction, because I like to do that. We will talk about earnings season, because we are in the last, today should be, in theory, the last day of company earnings. In fact, if companies aren't out by 4 o'clock tonight, they will be suspended from the ASX on Monday morning. So they've got a good reason, or not 4 o'clock, they're out by, what, six, I think the market announcements seem to close these days?
Six, seven.
In any case, if they're not out today, they won't be trading on Monday. So every straggler will be trying to get their earnings out as quickly as they can. There's a couple of big names that have reported this week, and I want to get your thoughts, and I'm not very opinionated, as the listeners know, but I may give some thoughts for myself. And as always, mate, we'll dip into the full mailbag. So what do you say? We get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. So there's apparently this thing called coronavirus. I know we haven't spoken about it before. I know there's no media headlines about it. Scott Morrison's not talking about it. Donald Trump's not talking about it. It's almost not really a thing. And yet, the US market is down more than 10%. I'm going to avoid saying the term because my blood pressure can't deal with it.
Correction.
No, don't say it.
Correction.
Don't say it. I will rant on that in a minute. It is worth stopping, though. I saw someone on Twitter, God love them, someone on Twitter this morning saying, it's the fastest correction in history. And I said, haven't you heard of 1987 when the markets fell 20% in a day? So, you know, it's easy to kind of lose context when it comes to, I reckon financial types have pretty much got the worst working memory in history. If scientists and police officers and nurses and truck drivers had the sort of memory that financial experts, so-called experts, seem to have, I don't know how the country would continue. Our ability to completely forget stuff that happened in the relatively recent past and sort of lose all context is kind of unprecedented, isn't it?
Well, I'm just trying to think, did you call me the financial types right now?
No, not you, other people. I'm talking about the people out there who are kind of losing their collective
stuff. Memory?
Mm. Well, yeah. I'll use another word. Losing their collective stuff about this kind of, as if this doesn't happen. You said to me, or didn't say to me, you said to our producer Will this morning as we walked up, 10% falls happen about once a year. You would think, based on the reporting, based on the social media carry-on, based on the collective losing our heads that seems to be going on around the place right now, that this has never happened before.
Yeah, you know what it is? I call it the clickbait world, right? I mean, right now, everybody's in a race to get the headline. You need to have the headline that people click, people read, people feel fear, they come back, they click again, you sell some ads based on that, it brings traffic to you. I'm being very,
very cynical this morning.
Yeah, being very cynical, but I mean, that's really it, right? I mean, you know, if you're on television and that's what you sell, if you're on the news, that's what you sell. I mean, you know, good news is never news, right?
Someone said on Twitter this morning in response to one of my tweets, if it bleeds, it leads, which is one of those very old cliches, but it continues to be true.
But it continues to be true, yeah. So that, you know, it doesn't surprise me. As I said, 10% is not really a big deal. I mean, when I say it's not a big deal, yes, you know, if the market is down 10%, you might be down actually more than that. It doesn't look
still
good.
Hurts, right?
Yeah, when you look at your portfolio and you think, oh, I had that money.
Right.
You know?
It literally, I could have. I mean, think about people. Let's pick someone with a $500,000 portfolio, right? Not everyone listening, not many people listening,
But make it a million, because then it's easier.
Well, for a lot of people, that's right. I mean, by the time if you can put money into super throughout your entire life, both your employer and yourself, and save diligently, most people these days will retire, not retiring now, but if you're working now, you'll retire with close enough to $1 million by the time compounding kind of does its work. It's kind of, I mean, that's the reality, right? If the market falls 10%, you're losing 100 big ones.
Yeah.
You could buy a couple of cars. You'd almost buy a Tesla for that. I mean, they had $100,000 on Monday that they no longer have today. Yeah.
Well, it's psychologically damaging.
Isn't it? I mean, yeah. I mean, people will be listening to you say that and say, talk about psychologically damaging, like the financially damaging, right? This money just literally evaporated.
You know, so I just disagree with the financial damaging part. The reason I completely disagree with the financial damaging part is that that $100,000 that you had, you know, call it like, you know, virtual currency or whatever you want to call it at that point, you were not really spending it, right? It was sitting there. It was doing its thing.
Right.
And it's quite likely that you didn't have that $100,000 maybe in November, now which you had it in February, and then you have now basically just gone back to where you were in November. Is it that bad?
And that, dear fool, is exactly the lesson you need to take from this, right? We don't, no one says, oh my God, I got 100 grand more than I used to have. Oh, that's wonderful or terrible or anything. Or most of them they say, I'm very clever. I did that all myself.
Yeah.
And then the money disappears again and you go, oh, that's terrible. Now, I tweeted yesterday. I'm mentioning Twitter a lot today, but I've been tweeting a lot this week, put it that way. The market was up 25% in 2019.
It's not supposed to be like that.
As of yesterday, it was up 25% just in the 14 months since last January.
That's also not supposed to be like that.
Right. But the point was that, you know, the big fall, now it's going to fall further today, so it'll actually be down a little bit on that number. So to be fair, that won't be the same after the market closes today.
So 20%?
But still
not supposed
right,
to be that.
Well, that's 2 years' gains. And so to some people, if you'd said to someone on the 1st of January 2019, so go back 14 months, you said to them almost exactly 14 months actually today, if you'd gone back and said, you will be 25% richer on February 27 than you are today, February 27, 2020, so year and 2 months after, would you take that? You say, absolutely. If I said, well, okay, but to do that, you're going to have to go up 25%, then up another 6 or 7%, and then down about 10, but you'll still be 25% better off. Do you want that? People say, absolutely. And yet, these bloody headlines and carry on from, and I don't, look, you know, not everyone, Doc, has had the time in the markets we've had, so I don't blame the individual listener or member or reader or just random investor for feeling kind of crappy about it, right? You need to know the way to contextualize this stuff. And your point is exactly right. The fact that you never really had the money in the first place, or to the extent you did, you've made it over the last 2 months, you've given it back, you're as rich as you were in December, and that was 25% better than you were 12 months earlier.
You know, I have a very cynical take on this. I think maybe many people actually...
You're a very cynical man.
I'm a very cynical person. Maybe many people actually understand this. Maybe they completely understand the fact, but you know, like, you
mate,
know, if you,
based on what I see in here, I think
but they, you know, they have to sell news. Like, it's not newsworthy to say, yeah, oh, you are up 10%, 12%.
Absolutely,
it's not a news item,
correct,
right?
Correct.
It's much nicer from a story point of view to say, oh, it's down, right?
Correct.
Which is, you know, I'm smiling. I'm not. It's not that I'm not sympathizing with the drop. It's just that that's the way news works, right?
Yep.
We always oversize and oversell the downside, right? I mean, it's even on different levels. Like, for example, we had earnings season, right? The company reports. Now, yeah, there's a headline or two about, you know, a company did very well, but if a company does poorly, actually that might get covered like three times.
Yeah.
Because it's more...
Oh, it does, right? Yeah,
it's more interesting to cover.
Yep.
So, and you know, I'm not going to... I'm just going to assume that the people who actually write these stunts, many of them actually know, but you know, they're working towards their goal of getting the clicks.
I think that's right, and look, honestly, those are also the more interesting stories, and they're not telling us what to click on, right? I mean, to some degree, they are kind of creating or allowing us to behave a certain way, but they're not making us do it. They're doing it because that's what we say we want, or if we don't say we want it, it's the old Britney Spears is a bit old these days, and it isn't quite the time. But you know, 3 or 4 years ago, there was the old days when people would literally, you know, they'd say, oh, no, I only read the Sydney Morning Herald or the Age or the Courier Mail or the Tizer for the serious news.
Yeah.
And what got the clicks? The Britney Spears stories.
Yeah.
And you kind of go, you know, even though we say we think that's what we want to read, and I've got to say the same a little bit when it comes to business news. The AFR published a whole expose on Get Swift. If you haven't heard of Get Swift, don't worry about it. You don't need to think about it. What's the other one they did? The video company, the video production mob. Who are they?
A Big On, I think. Was it Big On?
Big On, that's right, yes.
Big On.
So anyway, and big stories, and they read like great soap operas. They're gripping stories, and they're stories of intrigue and disaster, and they're the ones we want to read, right? The dollar value of those companies, the money they made or lost, is absolutely immaterial to the size and the shape of the market, as you say. The big story, I mean, you know, again, I'll reference another tweet. I'll try and make it last time because no one wants to hear me do that. They can read my Twitter account if they want to. you know, the reality is that we talk about the biggest points drop in market history, which apparently was yesterday or overnight on the US markets. Now, is it true? Yes, of course it is. The big story should be, if we're serious, the market has put on credit so much value over the last 30 years that we can have the biggest points drop in history, and it's less than 4.5%. Like that, you know, that is the real story here, that if you can lose, I saw another tweet that the market's loss today was greater than the entire market value 30 years ago, which by definition means the market's gone up 20-fold in 30 years, which that's the story,
that
right?
Is
that's,
a phenomenal,
that's the big story.
That is the phenomenal thing to think about, right?
Right.
Yeah, if you keep perspective and you think about the drop, irrespective of the gain, I think that is the phenomenal thing. Yeah.
All right. So that, look, that's, Phil, I get people are worried. We see emails, we see tweets, we see, we get questions all over the place, questions at our discussion boards, at our Motley Fool services, asking, talking, worrying about these kind of things. Hopefully we've given you a way to think about it and contextualize it. As Doc said, it's very tempting for headline writers to write the things we're going to click on. It's very tempting for us to see the worst in things, just what humans do. We're not saying that now this is the bottom. We're not saying that some falls aren't even warranted. There are absolutely overpriced shares from time to time, maybe even entire sectors, sometimes even entire markets. So we're not saying that nothing can ever go down, nothing's ever going to go down further. What we are saying is that over time, the wealth creation from investing regularly is phenomenally larger than any short-term drops. So just keep that in mind as you think about what happens to your portfolio today. Now, for all I know, the market could close up today. I think it's very unlikely, but it's possible. Just keep that in mind when you think about how you're investing, what you're investing in, the decisions you're making in your investing. Don't get whipsawed by the market. Don't get whipsawed by the headlines. If you like the business and the long-term profitability is going to be good, there's no reason to sell your shares and potentially even reason to buy some more if the prices are attractive enough. Anything to add on that, mate?
No, sir, I'm not going to add anything.
Now, I do want to talk to you about, though, so for all of that, let's think about what, and frankly, I read a great line, I wish I could remember who it's from, talking about investing, saying, I don't predict, but I prepare. I think that's a useful way to think about investing, right? So I don't know where the market's going, I don't know where the economy is going. What I do is I make sure my portfolio is constructed appropriately such that whatever economic conditions happen to kind of, you know, come along will be sufficient, will be enough, will be, you know, my portfolio can withstand. So on that basis, I do want to talk a little bit about the macro. So we're seeing heaps of, you know, travel being cut by the millions, certainly tens of thousands. We're seeing economic activity seem to slow. We've seen companies from the biggest of them all, Apple, right down to some of the littlest Australian companies, talk about the impact of coronavirus on their numbers and potentially the long-term impacts. We're also seeing tourism numbers down right around the world. It's not impossible that this is going to be a tough outcome economically, at least in the short term. The RBA is meeting next week. They may or may not decide to cut. Thank God the government's finally listening. And again, politics aside, pure policy, the government had said up until, I think, about 3 days ago, there was no chance there was ever going to be any fiscal response to the economic weakness. The budget surplus was all it was about. Thankfully, Scott Morrison yesterday is starting to soften that language, because if it's needed, taking an ideological view rather than a pragmatic one would be a crazy thing to do. So again, politics aside, whoever's in the lodge, they've got to do what they need to do to make sure the economy is protected to the degree possible without, you know, you can't create magic, but there are things that governments and regulators can do. All of that said, mate, where do you feel like we're at economically, and what should our listeners be preparing themselves for?
Yeah, so economically, maybe I'm the Debbie Downer here. Economically, I actually think we're not in a very good position because of too high household debt, and I think tourism is a big sector. It hurts us. Education sector, especially with overseas students being locked out, it hurts us. We have had, I think, a number of things that have all, I guess, come together in sort of the wrong way, right? So we had, you know, we first had no rain, right? So we didn't have rain when we needed the rain. So, you know, farmers were talking drought. Then we had big bushfires, and then we had lots of rain, right? And then we had coronavirus, and that's sort of going on. So I think, yeah, economically, I think maybe we're not in a bad state, but we're not in a great position. And sort of maybe our interest rates also reflects that. So that's my overall view of the economy as such. That has implications for individuals. But I mean, if you're Investing, though, it doesn't mean that there are no companies to invest in. There are companies to invest in pretty much in any market, right? But I'm overall mindful of discretionary spend, things that are exposed to local travel, to some extent, maybe even retail. Although, the retail world sort of is split across, different things. So, certain retail are going to be, under pressure. Some are not going to be under pressure. So that's the way I'm sort of, I'm viewing this. And then, of course, there are companies that have more sort of global exposure, which, will be able to sort of smooth out some of the local specific issues. But, even global companies will not be able to smooth out sort of the coronavirus problems, however short term they are, because it's basically a global problem.
My view is that, and I'll get your thoughts, my view is that for all of the short term issues, as long as the companies you're investing in aren't going to go broke, this is a short term hiccup. You should be able to look to where the company will be a year or 2 years from now, rather than worrying about the next 3 months, particularly when it comes to share price and investing. And in fact, if the market doesn't do that, if the market ignores that and marks them down, pricing the temporary as permanent, that should be an opportunity to buy. I'm not super worried about almost every company I own or any company I own. I'm not worried about most of the companies on the ASX, because unless they've got too much debt or unless the disruptions are so dramatic that it literally puts their entire existence at risk, when things get back to normal, and they will, things should be okay. Do you have a thought on that?
Yeah, I think I broadly agree. So I'd stay away from companies that have debt.
So just clear, any debt or just inappropriate levels of debt?
Well, those that have high levels of debt. I think a couple of things happen, right? One of the things that happens, I think, and I wouldn't discount this, is I think we need to realize that there are some companies which are relatively small, right? So bigger companies have the ability to withstand difficult times for longer. They have, bigger workforce, bigger exposure, bigger balance sheets, and things like that. So that if you've got a small company, relatively small, and a lot of Australian companies are actually small relative to, say, global comparisons, right? So I think I'm mindful of that. I might be sounding like a Debbie Downer. What I'm trying to be is it's good to be pragmatic and think about where an individual company stands. So that's one. I wouldn't discount... No, well, I completely agree that it's very hard to know how a market is going to price the obvious effects we're going to see in the second half, for example, right? And we don't know how that's going to carry forward into, say, the next, right? I mean, what I'm sort of mindful of one thing. There are certain types of companies where there's going to be pent-up demand, right? So if people are going to buy a certain thing anyways, and they're not buying today because... either that product was not made, or service was not provided, or they just decided to defer for whatever reason, that will result in pent-up demand.
Right.
However, certain things are discretionary, which if they didn't happen now or got canceled, are not going to happen. So, for example, travel, I think, is entirely in that discretionary bucket. A lot of the travel that is going to get canceled is not. It's basically, I'm basically distinguishing between repeat versus non-repeat. So I'm a big fan of businesses which have this sort of sticky, recurring style revenue.
Yeah.
They're in a significantly better position to withstand shocks than businesses that, depend basically on the discretionary spend.
Yep.
Travel is one of them. So I think, travel is basically, it's not repeat. If somebody was going to come here in January and they didn't, they're likely not going to come here.
Yep.
Right?
That being said, I don't think it's going to impact the number of people who come next January.
Well, it's not, but this is gone, right? So this is gone. And therefore, in a valuation sense, that's basically is gone. Whereas, the other so there might be a company which is going to see an uplift when situations normalize, whereas these companies are going to go back to maybe normal, right? And then, of course, in the odd case where something, if the situation remains a struggler for a long time, then these companies are going to suffer even longer, right? So I'm just mindful of that. I'll just say, again, there's a price for everything. So if the price is right, of course, that would make complete sense. But just keep that in mind.
I think it's fair. All right, so... That being said, I largely agree. I do honestly. I used a cafe analogy last week. I don't think I used it on the podcast. If I did, my apologies for repeating it. If you owned a cafe and you paid $300,000 for it, pick a number, and council were going to do works out the front for the next 3 months, that was going to halve or worse your profit for those period of time. There's only so much you can do about that. That being said, I wouldn't then go and sell my cafe for half price just because my profit was half for the next 3 months. If it's going to bounce back, if people are going to come back to the cafe after the works are finished, then expecting you should sell the cafe for half the price would be crazy. Flip side, if you're walking past a cafe that's being sold for half price because of some temporary problem, again, you should generally speaking be prepared to pay that money because when sales and profit bounce back, well, guess what? You've ended up getting a bargain. So as always, look through the short-term issues to the long-term. If those short-term issues, as Doc said, become problematic, either because they put your business at some sort of existential risk or if there is some secular permanent change for some reason, and I guess if you're super pessimist, you might say, well, people will always travel less as a result. I think it's remarkably unlikely, but you could take that view. And if that was your view, then you should factor in that to your future expectations of profit. As always, any valuation should be the sum total of all of the future cash flows, not just this year's. And if future cash flows are fine, yes, you should pay a little bit less because this year's cash is down. But if next year's cash is higher again, then you can pretty much, I won't say take it to the bank because it sounds too confident, too guaranteed. But just think through this and say, okay, if, easy example, Woolies are going to sell the same number of baked beans in a year's time they did today or yesterday, more to the point maybe. If the share price is knocked off, and again, Woolies is a bad example because I think it's overpriced. But conceptually, there's no reason why Woolies shares should be worth any less because of some short-term, temporary, and frankly, even tangential problem. But hey, if the market's offering you a better price for a stock you like, you should like it even more. Any more on that, mate?
I have a couple of things. So one is, I think the fundamental assumption, okay, there are a couple of different things. When there's a sell-off and market, general market sell-off, a lot of things get sold off, which means you actually have got a larger, I guess, pile of things to search from.
Good point, yep.
Right? So I would say look at the slate.
Yep.
And choose the best, which is, well, the best is in, mm-hmm. like, you know, and the best can be defined in multiple different ways. But, you know, I guess look at the best value versus, you know, opportunity trade-off, right, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's one way to think about it. So that's the context in which I would say that, you know, if you're thinking about travel, well, maybe travel is sold off, but maybe something else is also sold off, but which is not affected as much as travel is, and therefore mm-hmm. that other thing is more attractive. Now, I'm just making that example up.
Yeah,
I'm just saying that is... one thing to think about. Sometimes what happens is a lot of growth companies get sold off more. So I'd say look at growth companies because they get sold off more, and growth companies by definition have growth. So therefore they're likely to bounce back again if they're going to survive through situations like that. I guess the final related point I would make is just because something is cheaper, say 20% than it was last week, doesn't mean it's actually a good buy. Again, the reason for that being that it could have been 50% overvalued at that time, right?
Yep.
So I think keep that in mind as well.
Yep.
So there's a little bit of, things to think about. But yeah, in general, you know, when there's a sell-off, there are opportunities.
Correct. So yeah, it's 20% cheaper by definition. If you liked it yesterday, you should love it a lot more today. If you hated it yesterday, simply disliking it today shouldn't mean you should buy it. Great point.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, almost lost, frankly. You and I were trying to go through the business news, try and catch some of the topics of the week this week, and it's been very, very hard to find anything other than company profit announcements, and even they've been absolutely swamped by market falls / coronavirus news, and those two have effectively been the same thing this week. But there were some companies that came out. I guess the first one we should touch on, speaking of coronavirus, is Flight Centre. Now, Flight Centre, I might even have a double high horse this week. I'll see how I go. Flight Centre downgraded its guidance, again, unsurprisingly, because of coronavirus. Again, no one should have been surprised by this. Maybe the only surprise is that people were surprised. And maybe they weren't too much because the share price didn't actually move on the news. Sometimes the market kind of gets it right. At least it expects this stuff already in advance. So no one was surprised when it came through. When it comes to, you mentioned travel in particular before, Flight Centre's guidance, obviously, I assume, not a surprise. What did you make of the numbers?
So, So here's Flight Centre is an interesting company. The reason I say it's an interesting company is that, now, I think Flight Centre is a good company, but I don't think it's a great company. Again, that's my view. Number two, I think with Flight Centre is, they're like with many companies, you know, companies report stuff. XYZ is growing. they exactly don't report the stuff that's not growing, right? So, of course,
but selective reporting.
Selective reporting, but that is not. That's not. I was looking at Flight Center's deck. They're actually one of the companies that actually report a lot. So they provide a lot of things if you're actually willing to look at stuff. Mm. So I would not actually even say that they're doing selective reporting, right? So their earnings per share is down. Here's the way I think about Flight Center. I look at Flight Center and say, okay, there are aspects of its business that I think are antiquated and old school. Mm. That doesn't mean they're going to die, but they're just, they don't have secular headwinds. Mm. You know, they've got secular headwinds in front of them. Mm-hmm. They don't have tailwinds behind them. And at the same time, they've got some, certain pieces of business which are great. Like, you know, like Aunt Betty, for example, you know, is a good online presence that they've got.
So we're clear, you're not saying you're Aunt Betty. We're saying it's the Flight Center's online travel brand.
Yeah. It's Aunt Betty.
Aunt Betty.
Yeah.
Which I don't know who came up with that. I've used
that in the past.
Oh, yes? Okay.
Yeah. And you know, I think sometimes you get really good deals from
okay,
them.
Okay, there you go.
So that's great. But here's the thing with Flight Center. I'm just looking at, you know, CapIQ, which is sort of the gold standard for data. Again, it's their data. But, you know, for the 12 months ended June 30th, 2016, earnings per share diluted was $2.42, right? Mm-hmm. Last 12 months is $1.98.
That's a win then?
Yeah. Well, $2.48.
You're saying it was $2.48, now it's $1.92.
Yeah.
I thought you were saying the other
basically,
way
this company's earnings per share have gone nowhere, but, you know, it's basically been bouncing around.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at this company, I mean, you know, what I see is that basically this company is might be growing everything, but it's the only thing it's not growing is really earnings.
Right.
And the earnings is what matters, right? To me, at least as an investor, earnings is what matters.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Like when I look at this, I don't know, you know, it's a TTV, you know, which is the total transaction volume might be growing, mm-hmm. you know, underlying EBITDA might be growing. But, you know, like underlying EBITDA, basically underlying operating profit of a business could grow. But, you know, a lot of businesses, basically what they do, they go and buy other businesses using the share. So this is what I call the quantitative easing in the share market, right? Because, you know, the central banks like to print money. A lot of our companies love to print money. So they print money.
Print shares at least.
Print shares.
Yep.
So they print shares, they buy more businesses, but they basically dilute in the process. So their earnings go up, their operating earnings go up, their revenue goes up, their TTV goes up. The only thing that matters really to investors is earnings per share. That doesn't go up, right? And I really am skeptical of the long-term value of those companies. Of course, like at a certain share price, maybe that's, even if the earnings per share stays flat, I would take it, you know, but that's probably like, you know, 10 times or 9 times earnings or something like that, right? But yeah, so that's what my take really on companies like Flight Center is. I'd buy them at like 6 times to 8 times earnings. That's where I would buy them.
Right.
Because I just don't see sustained earnings power in these businesses. If I saw sustained earnings power, and I'm really ignoring underlying operating profit because, you know, I can't take that home, right? So that's what I think about this. And again, the last thing I've not factored in here is, I guess, the situation with interest rates. I guess that, you know, as the interest rates stay low, sort of the effective PE goes up.
That's the heart. That is, for everything else that we talk about as investors, and rates always matter, but The uncertainty has never mattered quite so much. I think, you know, we talk about earnings growth, talk about business models, we talk about all that other stuff. Almost all of that is not, it's not irrelevant at all, but it's almost insignificant when it comes to, so hypergrowth companies are different because they can grow at rates at where the interest rates don't matter quite so much. But if you're an average company, I don't mean average is in bad, I mean average is in, you know, literally run-of-the-mill, middle-of-the-range company. The future interest rates probably matter more to your share price than almost any other variable that, you know, with a reasonable range. With Woolies grows sales at 3% or 2.5% or 4% is almost irrelevant relative to the interest rate that investors are using to value the company.
Yeah, but you know, irrespective of whatever the situation, I mean, the interest rate is the interest rate is the interest rate. It's going to be the same for all the companies.
Yes.
My preference is going to be to buy a company that's going to grow earnings or has the potential to grow earnings, even if it has very little earnings today, versus buying a company that basically, earnings are basically flat, right? So with Flight Center, right now I'm not touching it.
Right.
But at a certain price, I might touch it. But at, you know,
it's not very extreme, is it? Let's be honest.
It's not very extreme, but I just don't think, like, you know, I think, you know, you need some earnings growth, however that earnings growth happens, right? But you need that earnings growth. And if the earnings growth is not there, that tells a story about something about the business, right? It tells something about the business. The business is there, and it's, you know, and like, you know, I love the red signs, and I you know, in the mall near my unit, that they've got like, you know, 2 flight centers, and I see them, lots of people working, lots of, it's all there, it's all happening. But as an investor, the only thing I get is a portion of the earnings. Or basically, that's, you know, number of shares I own gives me access to the earnings, whether or not it's in dividends or not. So I really don't care about anything else. The only thing I care about is what their earnings profile looks like. And, you know, I think personally, you know, 13 times is okay. But as I said, you know, I'd demand, in bigger discount. The other thing I'll point out is 13 times of trailing earnings, right? So it's probably much higher if I look forward.
Yes. Right? Particularly for this current financial year.
Yeah, in current financial year.
So, I would say, for what it's worth, mate, I'm going to take a different view on that, only partly to be argumentative, partly for fun. Just say that, you know, people who do price it down based on the current year's earnings are actually going to be undervaluing the company, unless you believe those earnings are permanently lower, right? So 13 times last year's earnings may well be 20 times this year's earnings. Pick a number, maybe 25, maybe 18, who knows? Call it 20. If you say that's too expensive, I'll pay less for it. If the earnings bounce back the year after, 2021, all of a sudden that's going to be very, very, very cheap. And I would caution people about selling, particularly selling. Buying, if you don't buy, buy. It doesn't matter so much. But if you're going to sell something based just on 2020's depressed earnings, unless that depression is permanent, I think you might be underselling yourself.
So the only thing I'll call out, earnings per share for Flight Center is average of $2.50.
Which is average?
Yeah, because that's where it has really been.
Okay, sorry, yeah. Over time?
In 2015, it was $2.54. Then it went down in 2016 to $2.42. Then it went down further to $2.28. Then it went up to $2.60.
Right.
And then it stayed at $2.60 and then again down. Let's call it $2.50. In fact, so as a matter of fact, the P is actually higher. If you think about the average normalized PE of this company, right? So you're not actually paying 13, you're actually effectively probably paying like, you know, 15 times right now.
I will, or 16 times. I will
so
bet
I'm
you
the odds.
Beats the market.
Okay, let's make a bet. I think I am happy to bet that long term this is a market loser.
How long are we talking?
5 years.
5 years, done. Put it in stone. We'll both figure out this after this. But yeah, if you're listening and you want to have interest, hold us accountable. Come back and see us in 2025. Mate, let's move on. That was a good rant. I'm impressed.
I love that good rant.
All right. So, here's one you're laughing. I have to mention it only because it's super news-y. Newsworthy is a different question, but it's certainly been in the news. Good old Retail Food Group, the company behind Michelle's Patisserie, Brumby's Bakery, Gloria Jean's, a handful of other franchises, which was absolutely dragged through the mud, justifiably or otherwise, by the good people at Fairfax Press. It came out this week, and it seems like, if nothing else, it's managed to staunch the bleeding. I think shares are up about 5%. Now, I will declare I own some shares, so just keep that in mind. When it comes to the business itself seems to have been able to stabilize, if nothing better. Now, the shares are about 10 cents each, so they're pretty cheap. Or they're still expensive, depending on which way the shares and profits go from here. Is Flight Centre through the worst of it, mate? Is this?
You mean Retail Group?
So what did I say?
You said Flight Centre.
Maybe that's a Freudian slip. Is Retail Food Group? Thank you. Through the worst of the bad news. It does seem from the numbers that they've been able to, they raised some capital, they've paid off some debt. It feels like this is a new base for the business. No comment about the share price. We know share price can go anywhere, but it seems like at least it gives it a chance to kind of start again from a new lower base. And I have to say, I did notice too, before I ask you to answer, there was a lot of franchisee love in the press release from the company, saying how important the franchisees and the employees were to the business. Whether they've learned their lessons or not, I'm not sure. They know they have to show that they've learned their lessons, and that did come through pretty clearly.
You know, before I say anything, I'm going to say the market has opened.
Oh, dear.
And here's the good news.
Yes.
There's some good news.
Hey.
We are down less than the American market.
Oh, that's no bad thing. hard though. The market was down 4.5% in the States. What are we down?
3.3.
Yeah.
So it's a win. I'm always talking about the win here. Just look at the bright side. You're not down 4.5. It could be worse, right? Oh. We could be down 5.
I'm actually down about along with the market, which, given my portfolio, is not a bad thing. All right. So Retail Food Group's down 4% as I speak. Retail Food Group, mate, is it a new base? Is it a business ready for recovery?
You know, I'm going to disappoint you with this one.
Oh, come on.
I'm going to really disappoint you
with
this
one.
And the reason is, while I do have coffee at Gloria Jean's.
Good man.
And, you know, I have that only for you. I actually have no view, zero view on, because here's the thing, right? The company, I was following the story with, you know, like with open eyes and open, you know, my ears are open, you know, all sorts of things. Even going and asking the store people what's going on. But, you know, like I've just lost track because they did a lot of things about raising capital, you know, getting rid of non-performing stuff or non-core things. Mm-hmm. A lot of things happen. I just don't know what's going on with this business right now. And, you know, the only thing is, my new rule of thumb is I stay away from shares with the 10 cents or below. So,
that's probably fair.
But I have no, so you tell me, because you own shares. I'm actually interested in knowing, is Gloria Jean's going to survive? Because that's the only part I care about.
Or at least your
Gloria Jean's. And the crust pizza.
Look, I bought shares, what was it, a couple of months ago, I think, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, when they raised capital, after the capital raising was announced, or after it went through, actually. I didn't recommend it to our members. It's, I think, the only ASX stock I own that isn't a recommendation of one of my services. The reason was it was just not of sufficient quality to be a share advisor recommendation, so I didn't put it in share advisor. I have some standards when it comes to the stocks that we recommend to our members. RFG was always more speculative than that, and it really was a story of either this thing is good value or it goes broke. The share price was, and remains, I think, to my mind, so cheap that it's hard to justify the current price being so low if this business is a going concern with a reasonable level of profit, and assuming that profit grows over time, the shares were just too cheap to ignore. Now, as I said, or it goes broke. And so that's not a zero chance, right? And that's why it was a tiny portion of my portfolio, less than 1% from memory. And it was just literally a bit of a, you know, a bit of a dabble, I suppose. I really do think that as a company, it has the brands and the foot traffic to be successful. It's a very, very nice business model, if it can keep the franchisees on the side, which is what it screwed up last time. So I don't know is the honest answer. I was pleased to see it managed to staunch the bleeding and basically deliver what it said it was going to do, and that has been unusual for a retail food group. So that's a win. Whether it manages to succeed from here or not is obviously a very, very different question. All right, let's move on, mate, to a couple I do know you cover and have a little bit of knowledge about. Let's start with, well, before I do that,
I only have little knowledge.
Well,
I like that caveat, actually.
Because I wasn't supposed to say it wasn't much. My point was the Australian understatement of, like, you know.
I totally love the fact that I know little, because if anything I say, I only know little.
You know a little about it, I said. You know little about it.
I just know little.
They're very different, very different.
I'm just
phrases.
Changing it.
Very different phrases. Okay. Stick with me. You actually know a lot about this company. Before I do, though, mate, I'm going to let our listeners know that they can get access to your advice at Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities. The service you run for the Motley Fool, this is an ad, as you may tell, it's a service that you run which is currently selling for less than $100 a year, if I remember rightly. I don't know anywhere else where you're going to get market-beating ASX investment advice for less than $100 a year, run by a bloke who knows his stuff and a team who know their stuff, just super high-quality investment advice, great insight, great thoughts, great education. If you are not a member of Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities, what are you even doing? You really should be a member. So go to fool.com.au/EO podcast to get the best from Doc and Kevin. That's the service they run. They are higher risk investment opportunities. They expect a lower strike rate than average, but a higher return than average. And that's exactly what they've delivered so far. A diversified portfolio. In fact, the entire scorecard of EO well and truly just smashing the market at the moment, despite even the short-term ructions we've been suffering recently. It probably will be more volatile than the average bear. It'll probably be more, have a lower strike rate than the average bear, but also thus far at least, and I expect personally, no guarantees, of course, we can't give those, we wouldn't give those. I reckon it's going to be a very, very good service to be a member of. So if you're not already, and you want a little bit of extra spice in your portfolio, go to fool.com.au/EO podcast, and you can get a special deal to join Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities. End of ad. All right, mate, so I wasn't even intending to do that, but I just thought, given the next couple of companies I'm going to talk about are companies that you've recommended in one service or another, companies you know well, was a good chance for people to get in on the inside of some of the advice you give. Tell me about the recent results from Afterpay.
Oh, okay. Interesting. So Afterpay actually had good results. I'd say, you know, if 100% increase of sales or stuff like that is we call it good. So, I mean, maybe I'm lowballing it here. but you know, like, so if you think about a merchant sales, so basically, you know, total volume of payment going through the Afterpay network, that was up a stunning 100%. So it basically doubled to 4.8 billion, 5 billion. Yeah, let's call it 5 billion, right? Which means sort of the annualized underlying sales now, if you look at sort of the last 3 months, is at 11 billion. So 11 billion of payment is going through the Afterpay network. That is pretty significant. They are signing up new merchants like anything. You know, they have their customer count is going up at a phenomenal rate. You know, they've just signed up. They're now up to like, 7 million active customers, right? So if you think about this, and you realize that they're relatively mature, though not as mature as you'd expect in Australia and New Zealand. They've just started scratching sort of the surface in the US. They have, you know, they have some presence in the UK, and they're off to a flying start again in the UK. And they've announced the intention to sort of, you know, expand into Canada. So I think this company is doing very well, executing on a strategy. It's got a team that really knows what they're doing. I like it. It's great. You know, it's great to see those sort of the underlying numbers for payment volume, you know, go up exponentially. And, you know, I think the key here to remember is, as long as this exponential growth happens, you know, more retailers, more customers, and as you sign up some of the big brands in the US, and then you're able to sort of take that concept further into, say, Europe and other European countries, because you've got the same sort of retail brands that you're serving everywhere. I think there is a flywheel sort of effect that can happen. And if that happens, then, you know, underlying sort of sales volume goes up through the roof. And when that happens, this company becomes really a cash generating machine. Right now it's not, right? And I think the key thing to remember is, again, you need the underlying gross merchandise volume, or, you know, GMV, sort of to go up a lot for this thing to actually generate a lot of cash. But I think we can see the signs that this thing can happen, and the fact that they've proven themselves in ANZ, then taking the concept, sort of taking the learnings from here, and then able to get fast growth in the US, off to a great start, and then off to a great start in the UK. It seems that the concept transcends borders, which is great. And
I was staggered by the fact they've got more customers, or more merchants, sorry, now in the US than anywhere else. I got to say, I'm genuinely surprised they got there that quickly.
Yeah, but I mean, see, so that's, I think, the win, right? I mean, if you're successful in that in the US market, it's no doubt that, you know, it's going to be better, because it's going to be significantly bigger than we had a population of 22, 24, 25 million or whatever it is right now. They're a population of 330 million. So
the traction they've got is phenomenal. They're not exactly super mature here, but there aren't too many large retailers that aren't offering Afterpay here these days, are there?
Yeah. Well, no, but, you know, the thing is that they started with online offerings, right? Then they've gone to offline offering, right?
True.
And I think it's a combination, so they can take share on both sides.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
And I think that, again, they're targeting a specific demographics, people who are, you know, trying to budget sort of how much to pay and when to pay. So, yeah, I think generally impressed with the execution in the US. I'm generally impressed with the execution in the UK. Hopefully a lot more scale to show. So, yeah, things are going well for that company. I like it.
Very good. I've said for a long time, I think this is either a $5 company or a $50 company. I don't really know which. So I've stayed away from it. And frankly, that's cost me a lot of money so far. It does seem to me that if the US foray is successful, they can genuinely lodge themselves permanently, even at a reasonably small market share, but a sufficient one to give it long-term success. This is worth well more than $50, right? If it can't quite hit sufficient escape velocity, for want of a better term, in the US, if it kind of, you know, fizzles out and can't ever quite just grab enough mind share, market share, merchant share, whatever else starts with M, to really, you know, stay in that market. If it has to come home with its tail between its legs, it's probably worth a lot less than the current price. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I mean, so the couple of scenarios here to think about, right? So that's basically what I was alluding to. So they need to get to a lot more scale, right? And given the gross domestic sort of gross merchandise volume that's going through the system right now, in the global scheme of things, is actually pretty small. So, right. So in a way, competition probably is not, you know, they have competition, but none of the scary competition that, you know, you would really worry about, right? Now, these sort of things can play out in many different ways. You know, Afterpay establishes a category, somebody could come in and sweep in, and basically overnight, you know, roll something out that's very similar. That could happen. You know, it could also happen that somebody who could actually do that doesn't want to do it because they're taking on credit risk, right? Mm. And not every company is interested in taking credit risk.
Yeah. Okay.
So those companies with big, you know, big wallet shares, they don't take credit risk. A lot of them don't basically just take credit risk.
They literally run the network. They don't actually handle the cash any other than just a pass-through mechanism.
Exactly. Right. So that's that. You know, and then I think there is a point at which, you know, again, I'm not 100% sure what that point is, but there's a point at which Afterpay basically becomes the thing. And when something becomes the thing, it takes a while to replace that thing, right? So that's the thing. I mean, I think the way you think about it, that's the way I think about it too. Like, I mean, I think about it that, you know, there's a lot more upside if the US keeps scaling. Mm. You know, I'd probably think that, you know, the share price is probably around 30. So it's probably, you know, if it continues with this rate of growth and can get a meaningful share in the US, this could be like a $100 stock, right?
Yeah, totally.
But if it doesn't, this could be a $10 stock.
Right,
you know, so the way I think about this is there's a big upside potential. There is a downside potential here. I think it's worthy of allocation if for those people who are growth tolerant and, you know, and volatility, those people who want growth and are volatility tolerant, this is going to be absolutely a volatile stock today. I think it's going to be down a lot. It is genuinely one of those disruptors out there. It's down like 9.5% as I'm speaking. So, I mean, expect a lot of volatility. It's got a great team. It's got, they're hiring people from some of the best out there. They make their vision. The vision is very clear. If you listen to their conference calls, they look really crystal clear as to what they want to do, how they want to get there. So, I mean, all of these things are there. Be cognizant. I mean, this is not something that there is a risk that it doesn't work out, and one needs to be mindful of that. So consider that the downside, and there's upside that you need to consider. Yeah, so I mean, it has a place in a growth portfolio. You know, size it according to your risk sort of tolerance. That's the way I think we size it. Mm. We own it. We own a percentage, not a small percentage, but it, you know, but not a very large percentage relative to the rest of the stuff in Pro. So and again, we like it. We would not like go all in and say, oh, this is a stock you're going to put, you know, buy 20%, put 20% of your portfolio. That's absolutely not what we are doing.
Yeah, for sure. Mate, sticking with the A's and sticking with Australian or Australasian, we'll say, companies looking to make a dent in the world, A2 Milk was also out this week. Another Australian company with big, well, Australasian, apparently they reckon they're a Kiwi company, but we've pretty much claimed them, haven't we?
It's just Australia.
Australian. They have,
Kiwis would hate us for saying that, you know.
Oh, you know, they look.
I'm just waiting for the day when we can call New Zealand part of Australia.
Well, the problem is they keep trying to claim Pavlova and Russell Crowe and Crowded House, and we all know they're Australian. So let's you know, we love our Kiwi brothers and sisters, but they should just lay off some of the iconic Australian actors like.
Have I just made myself not welcome in New Zealand?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
We won't be doing any guest podcast episodes over there anytime soon. Yeah. But we do love our Kiwi brothers and sisters. My best mate's a Kiwi, and proudly so. So, g'day, Simon. All right, let's move on a little bit from that, mate. So, to A2 specifically, I've always been a little bit nervous about A2 because I've worried that this is a company built around a product and a product built around a single proposition, and that is the A2 milk protein, right? And for as long as people think, believe, maybe even one day it gets proven, that the A2 protein does help, or at least the absence of the A1 protein is beneficial, this is a great stock. If they ever lose that idea, and I've always been concerned, maybe too much, by the way, I remember way back in the day, my old man used to take garlic tablets like they were going out of style. Garlic was the thing everyone was taking. All of a sudden, no one takes garlic tablets anymore. Now, Blackmores was okay because it did a whole lot of stuff. I own Blackmore shares for the record. Did a whole lot of stuff other than garlic, but there's a brand called Kyolic Garlic, which was all about garlic, which suffered massive falls, never really recovered because it was all about garlic and that was great while garlic was good. And then once the ship sailed, there wasn't much left. Where does A2 sit on that continuum in your mind?
All right. Okay. So I wrote an update, which I called Why We Love or Why I Love the A2 Milk Company.
Okay.
I think I wrote that yesterday. So I'm going to first debunk part of your Blackmore's theory that you applied here. Not quite debunk, but I'm going to just sort of
I'm not saying I'm right, by the way.
No. So I'll just try to, I guess, answer that concern. So one of the things to realize, just like Blackmore's has multiple products,
Yep.
A2 also has multiple products.
Yes.
Now, at a very high level, we can basically say A2 is selling good milk of a certain type, but it's selling multiple different milk products, right? So it's selling infant formula, it's selling liquid milk, it's selling, you know, creamers, it's selling packaged, you know, milk, you know, long life milk and things like that, right? So it's a bit like in a way, and it's selling premium in some sense. It's premium, you know, it's creating premium, whether it's via branding or something, right? So I don't think it's at any absolute risk in that sense because they've got multiple product lines. Now, of course, now if someday somebody comes and says, oh, A2 is really bad for you, then I think they've got a problem.
Right.
But here's the thing. That day nobody drinks milk because every milk has A2.
Right,
so,
right.
So I think, you know, even from a competitive point of view, you know, I think that they're relatively safe as that. You know, and the way I think about A2 is like, I think part of it is their strategy to basically acquire customers, right? You know, you acquire customers, you decide. It's just basically like saying, you know, I'm going to have vitamin C and it's going to somehow make you better, right?
Yep.
I mean, it does not. Like most of the vitamins are basically useless unless they've been prescribed by your doctor for, you know, some deficiency.
Allegedly.
Right? Well, that's the fact. So you don't need vitamins unless they've been prescribed, but people still have it. So, you know, it's one of those things. On the infant formula, though, one of the things that works for a company like A2 or any company that actually has premium infant formula is that basically you're selling infant formula to customers who want to feed their children the best. Mm-hmm. And I think that proposition is very strong for young families, right? And I think that's the proposition that a lot of these, you know, the Bellamy's used to exploit the same sort of proposition in a different way, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the, you know, that I look at, I don't think of this as the A2 company. I think of this company as a premium milk brand that sells a bunch of different milk products.
Right. But I think devil's advocate though, I mean, at some point when people no longer associate A2 as being necessary or premium, the whole thing can still come undone, right? You know, and I'm not saying it's even necessarily likely, but conceptually at some level, if, you know, like garlic's not been proven to be bad for you, people just stop bothering to take it. At some point, if people say, well, A2 is not bad for you, but I don't really see the point in taking it, you know, science or fashion or fad has moved on. I get that it was at some point. Now I want to have goat milk. Now I want to have almond milk. Now I want to have cow milk from blue and yellow spotted cows. You know, whatever the new thing is, may well take away. A2 doesn't have to be disproven or even you know, proven to be bad for you for people to simply say, I'm kind of moving on.
Yeah, well, I sound like a low probability. I mean, people have for yonks and ages and for like, you know, centuries have had milk of some form or the other. So, yep. I mean, I think kids are going to have milk anyways. Yeah, I mean, what is absolutely possible is the premium that they're getting, and therefore the, you know, one of the good things in the results was that, you know, the mix is shifting a lot towards infant formula, and the infant formula part is where the premium is, right?
Nice.
So, in a world, in a different version of the world, it is possible that premium disappears, or people start, you know, they have to compete on price. Mm. As long as that happens when you've got, you know, substantial scale and substantial penetration in the market, I mean, that's a very different point. Whenever that happens. I think that's a question of worry, right? So the pricing power of the brand is definitely a concern, and one needs to keep that in mind. Right now, it has not been eroded. Right now, it's fine. So, and, you know, again, these things, yeah, it's not a consumer. It's not like Louis Vuitton bags, right?
Right.
So we need to be cognizant of that. It's not Louis Vuitton bags. People are not going to line up. People do line up actually to buy, you know, and they're quota limits. So it's kind of like the Louis Vuitton bag of milk. But yeah, I do realize.
I want to say that in the back of their packages. A2 milk, the Louis Vuitton of milk.
Well, like, I mean, they might earn. And if they do, they should credit me for that. but I mean,
with
you know.
I'll
take a fee. I'll take a fee for branding, advertising, and whatever not. But I mean, you know, like, I mean, right now you can think of it like that, right? But if you do not maintain that for some reason, and that point, of course, you need to revisit your investment thesis. thus far, I think none of that has been an issue because they have phenomenal growth even in ANZ, where it is very, you know, very dominant. In Australian milk grew by 10%. That is like phenomenal. They've got very high operating margins on that side. The China operating business has got significant. And here's the interesting thing. This is almost like an anti-coronavirus stock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because while people are all, you know, worried about coronavirus, they still got to feed their babies. And in fact, they probably want to feed their babies the best thing.
Right.
And you can buy this stuff online. So it just gets delivered by, I don't know, by some robot or something. But people are still buying this thing. So in fact, this is one of the few companies that had, so far, it doesn't look like we've been impacted. So
you do have to wonder stuff. I mean, and I own Amazon, you own Amazon. You do have to wonder about just massive tangent here, but coronavirus online retail. Like, I mean, apparently Zoom shares are up in the US because everyone's supposed to be going to telecommute. Frankly, that was Skype back in the SARS days. I've been here before. I've seen this movie. But you got to think, like, someone like an Amazon, like, you know, if it's going to stay home, not go to the shops, you'd imagine, I mean, of all things, an Amazon or you know, some other delivery service, you got to figure that's a boon for those guys. The fact the shares getting knocked down for those companies as much as everybody else, it does seem there's a little bit of indiscriminate selling, doesn't it?
Yeah, like, I mean, I don't know how much. I have not actually looked at what the Amazon. Amazon
sure
share price has, from what I remember, hasn't been hit that hard because I guess, again, the online factor. Like,
I just mentioned, so it was down 4.8% overnight. I've just looked it up.
Everything is down.
That's my point. Yeah. And you kind of go, well, hang on. But like, if you're going to say coronavirus is a big deal, therefore, okay, let's sell off tourism stocks, let's sell off travel stocks, let's sell off consumer discretionary, like physical retail companies. Like, you got to go to the shops. Okay, you sell off Westfield. Even at the very worst of scenarios, the company's going to win out of this?
Yeah,
it makes no sense to me that Amazon gets sold off.
One of the things that does hurt Amazon, I mean, just again, we have moved in a massive tangent.
Huge.
But, you know, because Amazon makes a lot of money off third-party sales.
Yep.
They manage the sales, right? I mean, a lot of those third-party could actually be hurt, or they might not have workers working and things like that.
True.
So that's potential for that. But anyways, going back to A2 Milk.
Yes.
So I think China results, fantastic,
right.
Both on the e-commerce channel and on sort of the China labeled in the mother and baby stores and things like that, you know, footprint increasing, everything is great.
Yep.
They're making a lot of investment right now, which is why sort of, you know, you're not seeing the operating leverage. The operating leverage actually disappeared in this half. That makes sense when you're seeing that kind of growth.
Except I would get that as a result of the earnings itself, but this is, as the market sold off 4.5%, Amazon gets sold off 4.8%. It's not a qualitative view. If they told us, I would disagree, but either way, at the point of earnings release, I get it.
The overnight
sell down with the rest of the market, again, even if you believe that some stocks should be sold off for that reason, when everything gets sold off exactly this or roughly the same amount, just arbitrarily, it does say to me that someone's not thinking.
Yeah. Oh, again, we have a massive tangent. Oh, one of the things that happened overnight, I think, and this was sort of the main news, was apparently the CDC, which is the Center for Disease Control in the US, is now tracking about over 1,000 people in California.
Right.
And California is in many ways the nerve center of many companies, right?
Yep.
So what I think people are really worried about, and that sort of reflects in the share price down movement, is if something that happened in China,
yep,
which is basically where, you know, you go into like this, you know, voluntary lockdown and people work from home. California being disrupted is a significant disruption in that sense. So I think, you know, I get the fear, but a lot of these companies are also companies that where people can just basically work from home. So I'm not really sure how it impacts, unless, you know, people are basically, you know, not buying stuff and not doing the businesses and not making any decisions. But anyways, again, we're deviating from A2 Milk.
Huge tangent.
But, you know, I think the only thing I'll call out is A2 previously, maybe a couple of years back, when it was growing its business, you know, first it was the suitcase business, right? Growing Australia, and the suitcase business with the suitcase travelers taking stuff to China.
Yep.
Then they built the China. So they've really done a good job of that. They built China up really well. Now they've sort of set up a pillar saying that, okay, we want to also do the same thing in the U.S., and the reason I'm calling this out is there's a lot of Australian companies that go to the US. Well, again, I call this an Australian company. Maybe the Kiwis won't mind this. That go to the US, and I get it. Huge market, right?
Mm-hmm.
Probably some halo effect. If you win the US, you can probably go to other markets.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of skeletons as well of people trying that, right? So I quantify that as an opportunity and a risk at the same time.
Right.
And they want to get a modestly about a US $100 million annual sales there.
Yep.
They were nowhere near there. They grew like, they doubled it to like some 30 million New Zealand in total sales, right? Mm-hmm. So they were nowhere close to that number. That's going to take a lot of investments to get there.
Yep.
And there is that risk that it doesn't work out as they think it's going to work out. And then they would have burnt a whole lot of money, right?
Sure.
So I think that's the thing I'll call out with them. You know, I'd much rather prefer they're focusing on sort of on the Southeast or the South Asia sort of, you know, so they're opening into Hong Kong, Korea. You know, there's lots of other places, Vietnam, Indonesia, like, you know, those are the places, Singapore. large populations, growing middle class, big middle class population. I think, you know, my preference is to stay there. But yeah, this is a strategy. Again, I would say that, you know, you could always say that, well, they should try, you know, if you win, that's a huge win. But yeah, that's the risk in my mind.
I would argue that'd almost be negligent not to try. If you can be successful in Australia and you're fortunate enough, clever enough, whatever, to be successful also in China or somewhere else, I would argue that even if you burn X million dollars trying to be successful in the US, it's almost negligent not to, given the size of the prize. If you have the working capital and an objective chance of being successful, even if it's a, I don't know, 10, 20% chance, don't you kind of have to give it a go? If you can spend, pick some numbers, $10 million to try and make it big in the US, and if you are successful, there's $100 million a year in revenue or profits forever, don't you almost have to do it?
Yeah, I don't disagree. But I'm just calling out.
I take the risk, absolutely.
Yeah. It's the risk. Yeah, I don't disagree with you. I think, yeah, it's probably, you know, as custodians of the business for the shareholders, I guess they have to.
Now, just for my ego, you say you don't disagree. Does that mean you agree?
Yeah, I agree.
There we go. Just want to get that on tape just once.
Yeah.
So
I
put it in the CV.
So yeah, you know, that was my longish take with a lot of detours on A2 Milk.
Mate, this has been a really, really good episode. We've got a little bit of time left, but you know we haven't got enough time for the whole mailbag, don't you?
There's not enough time.
You know what that means?
I have no idea what that means.
Ring the bell, mailbag episode this Sunday.
Ding, 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 ding.
That's a good bell.
Yeah.
Digital bell, but a bell. Get excited, fools. If you love what we do, hopefully you do because you're listening, a little bit more coming your way this Sunday. Yes, it's becoming something of a thing, but that's because we're getting some great questions. We do have time for probably one question. I was going to say one or two questions, mate, and I looked at my first question and thought, yeah, we've only got time for one.
Value stocks.
Markets. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
The question comes from John, and John says, hi, Doc and Scott. Oh, dear. Are you ready for this? He says, Doc, you mentioned you may look at Commonwealth Bank at a PE of about 10 to 12. That was in a recent podcast. Somehow you managed to say you would possibly even look at Commonwealth Bank, which was enough of a shock for me when I got up off the floor. He said about 10 to 12, and that's a decent discount. He says, implicitly, your discount rate to the price to price the stock within about 9%. So discount rate is kind of the rate at which you discount future sales growth, blah, blah, blah. Basically, he's saying, look, 10 to 12 times your discount rate about 9%. He said, but Tesla, you mentioned that once or twice before, doesn't have a PE ratio at all, but on forward earnings estimates, some say it's roughly 80. If the current share pricing is still acceptable, that translates into an implied discount rate of about 1%. So 100 divided by 80, 1 and a bit. Again, 10 to 12, about 9%. So that's kind of the math that John's doing. I suspect your defense would be that it's reasonably priced given there's a huge difference in the growth trajectories of the two companies. Fair enough. But my question is, how could you require a return as low as 1% for a stock which remains both volatile and nowhere near risk-free? Why don't you want money, Doc? Why are you so prepared to make such a tiny, tiny return on some... He's staring at me with...
The reason
we might have to start videoing this. The look you just gave me then was absolutely... Stopped me in my tracks.
You know, the reason I was giving you the look is here's how John and you both have put me into the situation where I was actually literally thinking tomorrow morning of doing something with Tesla options.
Oh, dear.
Which now I can't.
So well, you can if you don't answer the question. Would you like to hold it next week?
No, I'll answer it. I can still wait. Maybe I'll get lucky and I'll make more money way.
John, you owe Doc some money at this stage.
No, that's fine. Here's the funny thing, right? So he's absolutely right that, you know, basically if you put like, you know, 8% discount rate and you basically assume 0%, like with Commonwealth Bank, here's what I think. Their actual earnings growth is basically close to zero.
Right.
The real earnings growth, you know. And
long term or short term or both?
Well, I think for the longest time, their real earnings growth is basically zero, okay. Right? Basically, it has been zero, like if they call cash profits and this and blah and blah and blah. But I mean, you know, if you look at, you know, banks, it's also hard to figure out what the real EPS is, right?
Now, are you saying, just for clarity, are you saying close to zero in the doc world of hypergrowth so that 0 to 5 is still zero? Or are you saying literally
no,
zero?
I think like this bank is going to do 2%.
Okay.
Like, basically, it's going to do 2%. Okay. Like, how much do you want to pay for 2% is up to you. That's number one.
Right.
So, I mean, probably somewhere around 13, 14, you know. Here's the thing, right? When you put, I'd have to take out my calculator, but, you know, but I'm not going to do that. But my guess would be that
somewhere. Not great radio, mate, no.
Yeah. Well, I have a I have a Google Sheet that actually does, I use Google Sheets.
Nice.
Calculator basically just assumes a certain discount rate and looks at, you know, certain assumptions for growth rate and what sort of is the in the hypothetical PE for that.
Yep.
You probably will land up with something like 14 or 15, maybe 15 for that scenario. Here's the thing. Everybody thinks Commonwealth Bank is risk-free.
Mm-hmm.
I'd actually say it's a very risky stock.
Okay.
Right? It's a very risky
stock or business or both?
Well, it's the stock and the business.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
And the reason it's risky is if you look at the indebtedness, you know, in the society and look at how much people owe and look at, you know, what the situation is with debt, then, you know, it doesn't look good. Right? Now, I'm not saying that, you know, there's going to be a run on the banks or something, but there have been situations where banks have, you know, basically run into trouble. Mm. That doesn't mean the depositors are in trouble. That doesn't mean that the homeowners are in trouble. It means the bank is actually in trouble, right? That has happened in a bunch of different places. And, you know, what happens? The shareholders actually come back winning, you know, holding a tin with no money in it.
Right.
Right? The other people are just fine. So I wouldn't say Commonwealth Bank is risk-free or any bank or anything on the stock market is risk-free. That's number one.
Mm.
And just to clarify that point. Yeah, with respect to Tesla, again, it's... Yes, it's, you know, the forward earning number he's quoting is based on what the consensus estimates are. I mean, you could argue that if something is growing earnings at 100%, maybe you're paying 80 times for that is not actually too much. I have said before, personally, I believe Tesla is probably the most underpriced innovative growth stock that exists today. Right? Well, it's one of my largest positions. And the reason it is my largest position is exactly for that reason. If you think about innovation, if you think about what it can do and what it is currently doing, and you know, if you look at cash flows that it's generating, the efficiency at which they're running, then it looks like it's a bargain,
right?
And you know, I think if you look at it with the lens of, oh, it's a car company and therefore, you know, how can it be worth $130 billion when Toyota is worth blah, blah, blah? Well, you know, that is basically... that's basically looking at the old world and sort of comparing it with the new world, and that kind of doesn't work. Mm. I think that's, yeah. So how much discount you want to ask for is really up to you. But if I look at Tesla as a company, I think a company which is basically disrupting multiple industries, it's disrupting the car industry. It is basically creating a new industry called electric vehicles, right? Nobody else really is creating that industry. They're leading the charge in creating the electric vehicles. They're leading the charge on autonomous. Mm. They're leading the charge on commercial electric vehicles. They are leading the charge on storage of energy. They're leading the charge on distributed energy generation. So, and God knows what else that they're working on, right? So, I mean, those...
But you're paying... So the thesis here is basically you're paying up... I mean, there is no basis for paying 80 times today's earnings unless there is growth coming down the pike. You're making the I use the word bet. I use the word bet deliberately, not because it's a risky thing, because I think all investing actually benefits from being thought about as odds and probabilities. So you're making the bet that the future growth that, as you've already mentioned, those different industries they're trying to execute in will mean profit be meaningfully higher. If that 80 is roughly right, you know, it's gone from not profitable to profitable, so that's a start. But it's going to have to do a lot more growth to justify the current price. You're saying, based on what you expect from the company, that's a good bet.
Yeah, like I think that's yeah. So he quoted what $8 something as the consensus estimate for 12 months entered 2020. I mean, the thing is that the earnings probably will, you know, quadruple,
right.
In like 3-4 years, right? I think,
which makes today's price pretty good, right? Like if it keeps growing after that, if it's on 80 now, pick the number.
Yeah.
Earnings quadruple, that brings the P down to 20. Now, the share price would go nowhere in that scenario. But if you could pay today's price for 20 times 2024 earnings, that in theory then grow at double-digit rates for a decent amount of time after that, that's a pretty cheap way to go.
Yeah, I think that's, yeah. I'm basically paying, you know, I'm paying a fair price for what people currently know. That's the way I look at it.
Right.
But at the same time, then I'm buying optionality. I'm getting probably the most innovative entrepreneur of last 30, 40, 50 years. He's basically like buying Steve Jobs plus Bill Gates plus like Bezos all in one combo.
Right.
I'm getting somebody who, you know, does not sell down their stock but buys with every capital raising. Somebody who has basically all their wealth tied to it. I'm buying with someone who basically says, I am the first person in and I'm the last person out of this stock. I'm buying for a company led by a CEO who basically says, I take no money. The only money I get is if this company's stock price actually does really well and the company basically does really well, then I get rewarded.
Right.
So in other words, you get rewarded, then I get rewarded. If you don't get rewarded, even if you get rewarded well, but not well enough, he doesn't get rewarded.
Right.
So I think that's a lot of, you know, so irrespective of the idiosyncrasies and all the other stuff that you got to, you know, take with that, in my mind, again, as I said, it's one of the cheapest growth stocks that's out there.
That's probably a good place to finish it, mate. That is it for today. Before we go, don't forget, you can subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And as I mentioned before, John, you do owe Doc a beer because he can't make his trades tomorrow. So I hope you feel guilty. Hope you'll buy him a beer next time you see him. In the meantime, if you like what we're doing, and John, you should particularly give us a high rating because, you know, Doc's going to get something for this. If you like what we're doing, please give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and tell your friends, leave us a review, say some nice things to us and to your friends about us. Excuse me. Don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness too straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. And you can get some Doc goodness by signing up for extreme opportunities at fool.com.au/EO podcast. Give us a little bit of love. Give yourself a little love, quite frankly, for less than $100 a year. Seriously, to get cheaper than that. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week and this Sunday with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.